You are listening to an exclusive podcast from Pituitary World News. Our subject today is pituitary lesions, especially pituitary adenomas. Here's Dr. Blevins.
This is Dr. Lewis Blevins of Pituitary World News podcasting to you from Northern California on this lovely spring day. It's sunny and about 75 degrees, and this is much welcome after the extensive amount of rain that we've had over the winter time. This podcast represents the first in a series of podcasts on pituitary lesions, in particular pituitary adenomas, but we'll talk about all sorts of things, including some of the pathways to diagnosis as we go along through these series of podcasts. The first thing you should know is that not everything that is wrong with the pituitary is a tumor. There are a number of different infiltrative and other disease processes, cysts, and other things that can actually mimic a pituitary adenoma, including simple physiologic hypertrophy of the pituitary gland. More on that later. Pituitary lesions are imaged all sorts of ways, including computed tomography, MRI studies, for example, probably the two most common pathways where someone is either diagnosed with or studied and found to have confirmation of a pituitary adenoma. A fair number of patients seen in our practice have incidental detection of a pituitary adenoma. A recent patient, for example, was found unconscious from other reasons and was taken to the emergency room and had a precautionary CT scan of the head that illustrated a tumor. Incidentally detected lesions are indeed, in many circumstances, clinically significant lesions in that they do require attention and treatment. It's estimated that 1 in 5 patients harbor a pituitary tumor, and this will be microscopically at the time of autopsy. One study showed as high as 27%. But these lesions only become clinically apparent in about 18 per 100,000 persons. I like to categorize the symptoms and signs of pituitary adenomas according to different schemes that I use to take a history and perform a physical examination. For example, first I consider hyperpituitarism, and that is there any evidence of hormone overproduction as a consequence of a pituitary lesion. Next, I consider hypopituitarism, evaluating whether there is evidence for hormone deficiency or diabetes insipidus. I also look at peripheral manifestations of hormone excess or deficiency, such as does a patient have diabetes from hypertension from Cushing's or acromegaly. And we also consider whether there are any mass effects of this particular pituitary lesion that has come to medical attention. For example, lesions can grow upwards and compress the visual pathways, leading to one of several different patterns of visual field deficits. Tumors can grow laterally into the cavernous sinuses and cause oculomotor abducens or trochlear nerve palsies, leading to eye movement abnormalities. Rarely, tumors can extend even more laterally and inferiorly and result in trigeminal involvement in facial pain or numbness. Some patients have tumors that grow inferiorly and can lead to nosebleeds or rhinorrhea of cerebrospinal fluid. And, of course, headache is another manifestation of pituitary adenoma. The headaches are variable and usually represent new headaches for a particular affected person, and there's more information about headaches in some of our videos and other articles on our site. So these symptoms and signs or classifications or groups, categories that I've mentioned, are considered in patients with pituitary lesions regardless of type. For example, even though a Rathke's cleft cyst does not cause hyperpituitarism, it can be associated with hyperprolactinemia and hypopituitarism and mass effects. A pituitary tumor producing growth hormone can be associated with mass effects, hypopituitarism, and obviously the excess hormone production in the state of acromegaly. We'll be talking about a lot of these things and more in the subsequent podcasts. Let me briefly, however, talk about pituitary hyperplasia that I mentioned earlier. This is basically an increase in the number of cells of the pituitary gland, and it's a situation that they're not tumoral. Usually they're increased in response to something. For example, the most common cause of pituitary hyperplasia that we see is postmenopause. In postmenopausal women, the ovaries have stopped producing hormones and the pituitary gland senses the low estrogen levels and makes more LH and FSH. It's also sensing the lack of inhibin production by the ovary, and you produce more LH and FSH as a result of that lack of negative feedback as well. LH and FSH levels are increased in attempt to try to stimulate the ovary, but of course it can't make estrogens. However, this whole process that leads to LH and FSH production also leads to division of the cells that produce LH and FSH, an increase in number of those cells, and enlargement of the pituitary gland. The same thing can happen in patients with chronic primary hypothyroidism that's not well treated. They can have an increase in the number of TSH-producing cells and have pituitary hyperplasia or enlargement of the gland. Patients who have chronic primary adrenal insufficiency also can get hyperplasia of the ACTH-producing cells and can even present with hyperpigmentation. There's also a subset of patients with hyperprolactinemia who have hyperplasia and not a pituitary tumor. And lastly, there's something that we call physiologic hypertrophy of the gland, which is usually seen in young menstruating women. These patients simply have an enlarged pituitary gland that sometimes looks globular or trapezoidal in shape. There's no evidence of tumor when you look at the contrast-enhanced images. Pituitary adenomas, on the other hand, are usually derived from one single mutated cell, which has some process that leads to dysregulation of its growth or its cell cycle and causes it to form a number of daughter cells, all coming from the original mutated cell. So it's a collection of cells that are all related to one another rather than, as in hyperplasia, enlargement or increase in number or proliferation of all the cells of a particular cell type throughout the pituitary gland. In brief, we classify pituitary tumors according to their size. Those that are less than a centimeter are called microadenomas. Those greater than a centimeter are called macroadenomas. And some of us, me included, refer to those tumors greater than 3 centimeters as giant adenomas or massive adenomas. Tumors can also be classified according to their growth pattern, but this is not done routinely in today's practice of pituitary endocrinology. We also classify tumors according to whether they secrete hormones, and largely most tumors are non-functioning or derived from the gonadotroph cells. Some are from the null cells of the pituitary gland. Prolactinomas account for about 40% of all pituitary tumors and are derived from the prolactin-producing cells. Acromegaly is about 12% of tumors and are derived from the growth hormone-producing cells. Cushing's patients have ACTH-producing pituitary adenomas derived from the ACTH-producing cells, and those patients with hyperthyroidism have TSH-producing tumors derived from the TSH-producing cells of the pituitary gland. Keep in mind that some patients have more than one hormone overproduced. For example, 15 to 25% of patients with acromegaly have tumors that also produce prolactin. About 2% of patients are said to have plurihormonal pituitary adenomas where they produce more than one hormone. I've seen combinations of prolactin and ACTH, for example. And then about 0.5 to 2% of patients actually have what we call double adenomas where they have more than one type of pituitary tumor. And I've seen that on occasion in my practice as well. Patients with acromegaly and Cushing's, for example, or acromegaly and hyperprolactinemia due to two separate lesions, or Cushing's and hyperprolactinemia due to a prolactin-producing pituitary adenoma. I mentioned the term clinically significant before. Let me talk about that a little more. Basically, I consider tumors to be clinically significant if they cause one or more of the symptoms or signs related to pituitary tumors, and also if they affect the patient and their psyche or their family or their job, for example. This becomes relevant when we're dealing with patients who have small pituitary tumors, and the decision is often made by some centers to follow that particular patient over time and others to proceed with surgery, depending on whether it's a significant, relevant lesion and has affected the patient in some way or another that is reversible by taking care of the lesion. In future podcasts, I'll cover the non-functioning pituitary adenomas, prolactinomas, the hormone-secreting tumors, including acromegaly, Cushing's disease, and TSH overproduction. And then we'll move on to pituitary cysts and related lesions, other lesions that can occur within the cella, whether they be infiltrative or inflammatory, or other neoplasms that we often see but rarely. And over the course of listening to all of these different podcasts, I hope that you'll have a good, thorough understanding of pituitary lesions and especially pituitary tumors. Again, this has been Dr. Lewis Blevins podcasting on behalf of Pituitary World News. Thanks for listening and keep in touch.